gouvernement du Québec.
CKUD 90.3 FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 15 days into the month of July. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, an interview with Stephen LaPierriere from Replik on the state of mobility aid repair services and the inaccessibility of terraces. Then, audio from COVID-19 and the perils of warehousing people with disabilities, held by the McGill University Institute for Health and Social Policy. All that on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @AvalancheCKUT. Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. For today's show, we speak with Stephen LaPierriere from Replik on the state of mobility aid repair services in Quebec and the inaccessibility of terraces. Okay, so hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you be able to describe your organization and what you do within it?
Yes, the organization is Replik, which stands for Regroupement des Activistes pour l'Inclusion au Québec. And what we do is we promote the rights of the handicapped persons, and we also accompany them and offer assistance when they are a victim of discrimination towards the different institutions, Commission des droits de la personne et de la jeunesse, Commission canadienne des droits de la personne. So that's a little bit, that's our mission. That's our mission. We do more than that, but that's our main mission.
So you recently penned an open letter on your Facebook page. What is this letter about?
Well, this letter is about one of our members. Actually, it's about our treasurer, Laurent Morissette, who last Friday night had a problem with his electric wheelchair. The problem was the bottom plate of where he sits broke down, which meant that he could not he was not able to sit on his wheelchair. So the only other option he had was to have someone transfer him to his bed when that happened. And he phoned the Urgence Dépannage, which is a service that offers small urgent repairs on your wheelchair. But when it becomes a major issue like Laurent is, they're not able to fix that. So he placed this call on Friday night, but the service being what it is, the service doesn't start before noon the following day when it's weekend and holidays. So he had to wait at least until noon to get someone to come and see him, and only to be told that there was absolutely no way that he could repair his wheelchair on an emergency call. So the net result of that was that Mr. Morissette had to stay in his bed all day and all weekend until Monday morning, where he was able to go to the repair shop and get his wheelchair fixed. So our point on that particular issue is the following. If you have a car accident, there's always a Canadian Tire garage that's open that can fix you up, whether it's Saturday or Sunday or on holidays. If you have something with your animals, you know, there's emergency services always everywhere, all through the province. So you can take your pet there and have it taken care of. But if you're a handicapped person and if your wheelchair breaks on a holiday or on a weekend, and if it happens at night, you're stuck waiting at least until noon the other day, the following day. And if you have something that's more, if you have something that's broken more than a flat tire or something very easy to fix, you're not going to get fixed until the next open days. So to us, it's clear discrimination, and that's what we're saying, and we're going along with that. We're getting experiences from people who have gotten a flat tire on their wheelchair and at night, and nobody could come and help them out. So if you're stuck in your wheelchair and you cannot walk and you cannot transfer yourself easily from a wheelchair to a chair or to a bed, what are you supposed to do? Mm-hmm. And especially if you're outside, if it's raining, or you're stuck in the cold, in the snow, so that it's clearly a discrimination. It's clearly a discrimination towards the handicapped persons not to be able to have an emergency service available all through Quebec for them to have to feel more secure, and just like everybody else. And it's also a fact where if you know that you don't have that service, it's something that's always on your mind and may prevent you from going out to have a social life or to work or whatever. So it's always a case where handicapped persons, the old saying goes, handicapped persons are second class citizens. But when you have issues like that in 2020, you're more like third or fourth class citizens, because nobody else in this society has this kind of service.
And would you say that conditions were standard like this prior to the pandemic?
Oh, yeah, it's always been like that. We have stories coming out that happened like 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago and all through Quebec. And it's one thing in Montreal, but we know. And we always suspected, but we know that it's worst in the regions, because when you're in Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean, or if you're in Rivière-du-Loup, services are even harder to get. But at the same time, when something happens to you, you're a citizen. You should be entitled to have a fair service. And if you're telling me that you're going to get your service within 24 hours, that's one thing. But if you're to get your service like 2-3 days after the incident happened, I mean, what are you supposed to do if you're not able to be, if you're not able to transfer yourself, if you're not able to do anything else, you're going to stay in bed for 3 days? Who would accept that?
And how does one's location, for example, you mentioned something about smaller towns getting less access to service. How does that impact the urgency at which people are addressed?
The urgency, it resides in the fact that if you cannot do anything, you need service. So it's one thing. I mean, you could always call 911 wherever you are to get immediate help, but 911 will not be able to fix your wheelchair. So there has to be somewhere in the there has to be some kind of protocol that allows everyone in every region to have an emergency number that they can call to get proper repairs done on their wheelchair fast, within 4, 5, 6 hours. And if they're not able to do their repairs within that time frame, at least have some kind of a service where they can supply temporarily another functional wheelchair, so that the person can at least get home and move around and go for their errands or whatever. Because the net result of those issues is that if that happens, you're stuck home. There's nothing you can do. You cannot go do your errands. You cannot do anything else but rely on other people. And if you're, as is the case, isolated person, because when you're handicapped persons, often there's not that many people around you, so you found yourself even more so excluded from society. So that's where the emergency lays. I mean, if I was to cut your legs and say, oh, okay, you're going to stay home for 3 days doing nothing, well, it wouldn't make sense. Well, when something like that happens, when your wheelchair breaks, it's the legs of the person that uses the wheelchair that are broken. And nobody would accept to stay home 3 days because something is broken, right?
Regarding the regional aspect, is there a difference between the way that, for example, a caller from Montreal would be addressed versus a caller in the Eastern Townships? How is this resource dispatched?
Well, there's a timing issue, not a timing issue, but a distance issue. I know that there are some, let me put it this way, repair depots in regions. But if you happen to live very far from that depot, it takes even more longer. And some of those resources, I think they're not open on Sunday. That had to be verified. But still, it's harder. Still harder to get access to those services when you're in further regions.
So if someone were to place a call, let's say Friday night, what would the process be of them getting help?
You'd place your call on Friday night, and the emergency services start at noon on Saturday and Sundays. So somebody would come and visit you on Saturday afternoon, and would try to fix what the problem is, but it still has to be a minor problem. If it's a seat problem, if it's an electrical problem, or another problem that a wheelchair might have, then you might not be able to have the technician fix the wheelchair, and you're still stuck home for the weekend.
And how do you feel the pandemic has impacted this service?
Well, we know that during the pandemic, the only services that were offered were emergency services. So we're pretty sure that there were some issues with some people with heavier problems with their wheelchairs, but they have not been reported to us so far. But we know that the repair centers, of course, during the pandemic, they were closed, and they only did emergency services at home. And now it's starting to reopen again, like everything else. So we'll see how that works out. But for sure, during the pandemic, it was tougher to get services if you had a bigger problem with your wheelchair.
And what kind of stories have you been hearing so far with the submissions that have come your way?
Well, we've heard of someone, like I was explaining earlier, someone getting like a flat tire at night around 11 o'clock, and it was in Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean. And fortunately that night, the person that was handicapped was able to transfer him into a taxi. They were able to get to their hotel. But there again, they were not able to get their his wheelchair fixed before 5 or 6 o'clock the next day, so that really puts a burden on a getaway weekend. So it's stories like that, people that are stuck home because their wheelchair is not moving because there is an electrical problem. And there again, it happens at night, so you get the technician the following day and he's not able to repair it, because that's more than the emergency service can do.
And do you feel that this problem is unique to Quebec, or is it seen in other provinces within Canada?
I can only really talk about Quebec. The other provinces, I would not advance myself to say that, because we're not 100% sure. But we would have reasons to believe that at least in areas that are outside the major cities or larger cities, the situation is probably the same.
And what steps can be taken to improve these services?
What people need to realize is that handicapped persons really have a life. They have obligations. They have family. So the steps that needs to be taken are emergency repair service have to be faster to reply, first of all. I mean, to me, it makes no sense that the service starts only at noon. So that's one thing that has to be changed. And the other thing, the technicians that come home have to be able to have more equipment, more knowledge, and more tools in order to fix on-site the wheelchair. And if worse comes to worst, if you cannot fix it, and it happens, you need to be able to have to supply another wheelchair, at least for the time that the wheelchair will be fixed.
So in your letter, you mentioned Minister Christian Dubé specifically. What would the involvement of the minister do?
Because one thing we learned with the pandemic is that handicapped persons are always evacuated from the public discussions. I mean, you've barely heard our politicians talk about handicapped persons during this whole pandemic. We feel that this situation that we're talking about, emergency repairs during weekends or holidays, nobody knows about that. It's not understood. It's not been talked about. And we're pretty sure that our politicians don't know about it either. So we're trying to raise Mr. Dubé's attention, since he is new at the Minister of Health, to catch his attention, to say, hey, something's wrong here and it needs fixing, and it needs fixing now. So the idea behind this is to tell him the stories that happen, because they do happen, and to help us out get a better service and more money if necessary for those repair shops to operate better and offer a proper service to handicapped persons.
And do you feel that this issue should also be addressed federally?
Well, actually, the wheelchairs that are supplied are, for most of them, if not all, are supplied by the government of Quebec, but through the Régie de l'assurance maladie du Québec. The problems that have to be addressed there. I don't think it's a federal issue at that level.
And what about on the municipal level?
On the municipal level, again, it's really a provincial issue, because those wheelchairs are the responsibility of Quebec. I'm sure that if there would one thing the cities could do is probably have some kind of depot available to those repair stores if necessary, to have spare wheelchairs or something like that. I'm sure the city could help, and I'm sure the city would help if they were requested. But again, for us, it's an issue that has to go through the hands of the provincial government if those repair services don't do the proper improvements to their services.
Going back to the city, you guys recently published a video talking about the inaccessibility of terraces. Yes. Would you be able to describe this video to us?
Yes, absolutely. We have two of our members, Laurent Morissette and Martin Dion, they went all through the main center quarters of Montreal to see how are the terraces, if they're accessible, if there's a possibility to get service for handicapped persons. And we do that year after year, but this year it's very particular because of the pandemic. The city has allowed the terraces to be bigger, wider, more seats, and that's all fine. We're not against that. Obviously, businesses have to survive, and we're all for that. But it was done fast. It was done very, very in a way that was unplanned, and permits for terraces were handed out business to business owners. The universal accessibility was not taken care or wasn't taken into account when they gave out the permit. So what you have right now are a lot of terraces. They are either not accessible, you cannot get on them if you have a wheelchair, or if they are accessible on the terrace itself, instead of having tables that are accessible to handicapped persons, you have picnic tables, which you cannot do anything if you're a handicapped person with on a picnic table. Or some tables have the way they're built, you know, they stand. With your wheelchair, you cannot get under the table to seat yourself comfortably to be able to eat or drink. So it's all that's part of the problem. It's really a problem of accessibility and of the furniture that you use on the terraces to seat people. So our guys went there, and there are many this year that are not accessible for handicapped persons. We've had discussions with the mayor of the plateau of Mont-Royal, Mr. Luc Rabouin, and they are willing to review the way that terraces are built in the plateau Mont-Royal, but that will be done only at fall for hopefully next year will be much better. But until then, if the terrace is not accessible, it's not accessible. So the point of that video was to show exactly how hard it is to get into a terrace. And sometimes even if the terrace is accessible, between the terrace and the wall of the business, there's so much little space that it's hard to get there still because it's not thought of. Universal accessibility is not thought of when they build the terraces.
Is there a sort of guideline available to business owners, either within boroughs or citywide, in order to best create a terrace that is accessible?
That's a big part of the problem. Plateau Mont-Royal is working on that. We've said many times to city officials that, hey, you issue the permits, you should talk about universal accessibilities to the business owners, because sometimes, and actually a lot of the times, we go out and see business owners and they say, well, nobody's told me that. I don't know about universal accessibility. And if I knew, I probably would have done something to make my business more accessible, whether it's the terrace or the inside of the business. So the large chunk of the problem issues from that. The city hands out the permits. They don't talk about universal accessibility, but they are the only ones who can control that, since they are the ones who hand out the permits. So for us, a big part of the solution goes through that. I mean, and we're talking about Montreal, but you can talk about any city in Quebec. If you advise your people that, hey, these are the rules for making your business more accessible, whether it's for the terrace or for the inside of your business, most of them would do it. There's no question.
We did an interview with Jody Negley, Action Accessible, yes. And they had a petition saying that while the lockdown was in effect, this is the perfect opportunity for businesses to really look at how accessible their spaces are. So, for example, if you're shut down for a period of a couple months,
you could install a ramp, or you could ensure that your hallways or your aisles are wide enough for wheelchairs to pass through. Mm-hmm. But one of the points she mentioned is that a lot of business owners, their pushback for suggestions of this is that there just isn't enough money for it. Either the city needs to provide it or they need to fundraise it. So do you feel that this should be a city initiative in order to get small businesses to comply with these kind of measures?
There is one already that exists. It's called Pram Accessible. So in English, it would be Pram Accessibility, I guess, which offers up to a certain percentage of your of the cost of making your business accessible. And it can be also parallel to another subvention you might make to make your business bigger or change the front of your business. So that already exists. So that's one part of the solution. But also we know that a lot of the business owners are not owners of their building. They're locators of their building. And sometimes the problem comes not from the business owner, but from the owner of the building. So that's another issue that's really a big part of the problem. When it comes to other solutions, there are, and again, with that program that the city has put forward a few years ago, they are not promoting it that much. In fact, we are probably the ones that are promoting it the most. And that should be every time you hand out an occupation permit to a business, you should make sure that they know that that this program is there and it's ready, the money is there, and they can help you out to make your business more accessible.
What steps do you think businesses should take now after, for example, they've opened a terrace and they've had feedback from disabled customers or potential customers?
Well, if for sure, you'll say I'm speaking for our community, but if I was a business owner that his terrace is not accessible, I would do everything possible to make it accessible within the reasonable that can be done. But I would certainly commit that for next season, I would make my terrace absolutely accessible. If someone cares to tell me what I need to do in order to make it accessible, and that's what we're trying to do. Every time we have a problem with a situation where a terrace is not accessible, we're writing to the business owners and we're saying your terrace is not accessible because there's a step or the ramp is too steep or the tables are too high or picnic tables. We try to explain that. We try to educate, the business owners as to why their terraces are not accessible. A lot of that education could be done also by the city. When you hand out the permits for the terraces, if you tell them, well, high tables are not accessible for people or picnic tables are not accessible, if you make that clear, then you'll solve a lot of those issues that we're having this year, because most of the business owners, they're not bad people, and they're not wanting not to have handicapped persons in their terraces. They just don't know. So there's a big part of education that needs to be done. And for us, the way we see it, the one common point where everyone will get the same information, is when you hand out the occupational permit for your terrace.
And what can listeners do in order to gain more information on either of these projects? Either your open call for testimonies regarding wheelchair repair service or your terrace video. Where would they be able to find information?
There are also the office, the Personnes Handicapées du Québec, that has a lot of information on that. And there are also working with that type of information. There are other organizations that have precise rules on that. Where to get it, aside from the Office des Personnes Handicapées du Québec, that's really where you would get the proper information. to thank you very much for the time. We really appreciate it. And hopefully, if any of your listeners have stories about inaccessible terraces or problems with getting their wheelchairs repaired or transport issues or whatever, I mean, our email is always open. Our Facebook page is always there also. You can reach out to us by those two means. It's Le Raplique, so it's le.raplique@gmail.com. And our Facebook page is Raplique. And we're always there to reply to our handicapped friends that need help or that need counseling or that need whatever directions they might need at the time.
All right. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CQT 9.3 FM. You are just listening to an interview with Stephen Lapierre on the state of mobility and repair services in Quebec and the inaccessibility of terraces in Montreal. If you'd like to contribute your experiences with mobility and repair services, contact Raplique through email at le.raplique@gmail.com. Spelled out, that's le.raplique@gmail.com, or through their website, raplique.org. Up now is audio from COVID-19 and the Perils of Warehousing People with Disabilities, held by the McGill University Institute for Health and Social Policy. This webinar took place on June 20th, 2020.
So we will have a three speaker. I'm going to introduce them in turn. So the first one, Jonathan Marchand, is an activist and advocate for the rights of people with disabilities. He's a senior network engineer who worked many years in Quebec and Australia for various internet service providers. He's the co-founder and chairperson of Co-op Assist, Quebec Cooperative for Independent Living, which aims to create a new self-directed personal assistance program in Quebec, which will allow all people with disabilities to live freely in the community and be included in society. The model proposed is based on similar programs in Norway, Sweden, and Australia. He's also a board member of Every Canadian Counts since 2017, an organization dedicated to bring about a new insurance program to fund community-based disability support systems in Canada. And he's a member of the Council of Canadians with Disabilities Ending of Life Ethics Committee, which aims to develop and implement strategies for promoting a disability right perspective on how to preserve and advocate for the human rights of people with disabilities in an environment where medical aid in dying has become available. So in that sense, he shares some interest with myself and the other speakers. The second speaker is Amy Hasbrook, who's been a disability rights activist for more than nearly 40 years. And her activism combines her personal experience with congenital and acquired disability with a cross-oppression analysis gained through involvement in the women's rights, anti-war, LGBT, and other social justice movements. She worked in architectural access and the independent living movement before graduating from Northeastern University School of Law in 1997, and her subsequent legal work concentrated on health and mental health law and implementation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So she's produced different kind of work, some groundbreaking report on prosecution and sentencing of parents who killed their disabled children in 1997. And that study led her to be involved with a disability rights-based opposition to assisted suicide and other end-of-life practices that may discriminate against people with disability. She served on the board of Not Dead Yet in the U.S. since 2000, and she's the founder in 2013 and the executive director of Toujours Vivant, Not Dead Yet, a project of the Council of Canadians with Disability to expand the reach of CCD's Ending of Life Ethics Committee, to which Jonathan belonged. And our third speaker, Heidi Jans. Dr. Jans specializes in the field of disability ethics. She's been affiliated with the John Dossiter Health Ethics Center since 2006. She's currently an assistant adjunct professor with the John Dossiter Health Ethics Center. She was employed as the curriculum coordinator for an emerging certificate in disability ethics in the Faculty of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Alberta. She's also a writer and a playwright, and published a novel for young adults, and her list of produced plays are very impressive and have been produced in on the stage, such as the Edmonton Fringe in the summer of 2001. She has also worked, like our other speakers, in relation to the care of the terminally ill. So so our three speakers are very well placed to understand the ethical, political challenges facing people with disabilities in a situation where health and life is threatened, and where health resources are limited. So so without further ado, I will pass. I will let Amy Asbrook take over. If you want to go first, Amy.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to try to share my screen, and hopefully that will work. And maybe I got to click share. Okay. Oh gosh. Okay, so this is interfering with my. All right. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a disproportionate impact on people with disabilities and people of color. This is partly due to the lower value placed on the lives of disabled people and racial and ethnic minorities. The highest casualty rates have occurred in nursing homes, prisons, and other institutions. Among residents, who are predominantly people with disabilities, regardless of age, and among workers, especially women and racial and ethnic minorities. And people who work in low-wage jobs, especially personal support workers and agribusiness, are overrepresented among those infected because of cramped and unsafe living and working conditions and lack of infection control procedures and protective equipment. Prisons have become a common custodial setting for persons with cognitive and psychiatric disabilities, and Black and Brown Indigenous people are overrepresented in the prison population. Physical distancing is impossible where multiple prisoners occupy a cell. Quarantine procedures have disrupted home-based supports, such as personal care and homemaker services, and other services that enable people with disabilities to live in the community, like home delivery of groceries and medications, often charge a fee or are overwhelmed or unavailable. Disabled people are mostly excluded from policymaking in response to the pandemic. And though the federal government has appointed a COVID-19 disability advisory group to provide policy guidance on issues related to the pandemic, none of the provinces has included disability activists in their pandemic response teams, and that's especially apparent in Quebec. The pandemic has both highlighted and worsened the problems of warehousing people in institutions that we've known about for 60 years, since the exposure of conditions at the Huronia Regional Center in Orillia, Ontario in 1960, and Jonathan is going to talk about that, so I'm just going to skip right down to the next section. Other problems related to the COVID-19 policies that have been implemented since the beginning of the pandemic. One of the policies that has been implemented, especially in Quebec, has been to increase wages for institutional employees to make up for staff shortage. But that has lured workers away from providing home-based care, and that has created its own problem. Proprietary software and digital locks make it difficult to repair or adapt ventilators and other essential medical equipment. People whose health deteriorates due to poor quality care, such as insufficient time to eat or poor wound care, are often placed on palliative care regimes, where food and water and other medical treatments are withdrawn, whether or not they have COVID-19. And so basically a lot of people are left to die that way. and medical assistance in dying, which is classified as an elective procedure, continue to pay despite the suspension of other elective procedures. The United Nations and Government of Canada each released policy statements on COVID-19 and disabled people. The UN document emphasized the rights of disabled people and suggests specific actions regarding healthcare, people in institutions, community living, income and employment, education, domestic violence, homeless people, and prisoners with disabilities. The Government of Canada's recommendations focus on support for vulnerable populations and are not very substantive. Ontario and Quebec issued triage policies, which drew fire from disability rights organizations for lack of consumer input in their development and because the protocols violated principles of non-discrimination, such as those described in the evaluation framework for crisis plans developed by some disability organizations in the United States. Both the Ontario and Quebec procedure protocols mention specific disabilities such as cognitive impairments, Parkinson's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and cystic fibrosis as criteria for exclusion. While neither protocol uses quality of life measures per se, both use the clinical frailty scale as a measure of a person's overall health based on their ability to independently perform certain activities of daily living, which is a no-no. Both protocols use potential for long-term survival as threshold eligibility criteria, which puts people with chronic illnesses and disabilities at a disadvantage for getting treatment and fails to account for the significant surrounding long-term survival probabilities. And institutions have found a way to get around the triage protocols. Though officials assure the public that the worst case scenario that would invoke the triage policies won't happen. However, that policies are only invoked if there is a substantial strain on the healthcare system, but there is no strain on the system if nursing home residents with COVID-19 are not sent for aggressive treatment in intensive care unit. This is de facto triage by age and disability. And this is a really important point because, you know, they're assuring us, don't worry, these triage protocols won't be invoked. But the reason they're not invoked is because people are being left to die. However, there is hope in fighting back. Nobody is disposable is a coalition of queer, fat, disabled, and people of color who have challenged discriminatory policies and created educational material. The Black Lives Matter movement has amplified the voice of disabled people of color. Especially active in that is Anita Cameron with Not Dead Yet in the United States. She's the multicultural outreach coordinator. As they speak about the intersectional nature of racism and disability discrimination, and in response to criticism, the Ontario triage protocol, it was withdrawn but has not yet been replaced. Quebec's triage protocol is being challenged by advocates who have launched a petition asking for it to be withdrawn. And finally, communication and accessibility options have expanded through the adoption of more flexible employment practices, such as working from home and online meetings. So the isolation that disabled people live with all the time has now become the norm for everybody else.
Unmute. Okay, great. So thank you, Amy. So I'll put on the chat a link to a petition in relation to that Amy was talking about, so that those interested in signing the petition and getting more information the petition being against the triage protocol in Quebec that could be problematic. It will be in the chat. Also, if you want to ask questions to everyone, yes, I will immediately, yeah. If you want to provide a question either privately to me or to the speakers, or to me addressing the speaker, I'm taking notes of any question you may have, and I will. We will have a question period immediately after the talks. And so the second speaker is Heidi Jans. Heidi, do you want to go? I'm going to pass it over to you.
Okay.
The COVID-19 pandemic has thus far been punctuated by reports of ableism in action. Of course, these events have almost never been reported on as instances of ableism. Rather, they've been presented as unfortunate consequences of healthcare systems being pushed beyond their breaking point by the pandemic. Among the most disturbing of these reports have been stories of COVID-19 outbreaks in long-term care facilities and group homes causing personal support workers and healthcare aides to fall ill themselves, and prompting those who remain to abandon their elderly and disabled clients. Interestingly, and tellingly, while the deplorable conditions of seniors languishing in long-term care facilities has, rightfully, garnered national attention in recent months, the abandonment of physically and developmentally disabled adults by staff at Participation House, a care home in Markham, Ontario, in April, was little more than a blip in the 24-hour news cycle. For both the mainstream media and the general public, there appears to be a clear qualitative distinction between the physically and developmentally disabled residents of Participation House and the, mostly, senior residents living in long-term
with COVID-19. All of these things point to the fact that Canada suffers from a pre-existing condition that is making COVID-19 much more lethal for entire segments of its population. The name of this condition is ableism. Disability scholar Veronica Chouinard defines ableism as ideas, practices, institutions, and social relations that presume able-bodiedness, and by so doing, construct persons with disabilities as marginalized and largely invisible others. Canadian disability scholar Gregor Wolbring notes that ableism and preference of certain abilities has been rampant throughout history. Ableism shaped and continues to shape areas such as human security, social cohesion, social policies, relationships among social groups, individuals, and countries. Ableism is one of the most societally entrenched and accepted isms. I find Professor Wolbring's summary of the all-encompassing scope of influence that ableism has in contemporary Western society to be quite accurate. Clear, yet unacknowledged, evidence of ableism can be seen in everything from the way in which buildings are built to exclude people who do not walk or see, to the way in which students with disabilities are taught that it's better to look, move, and behave as much like their non-disabled peers as possible, to the way in which terms associated with disability are used as insults in common parlance. Unlike sexism or racism, however, ableism remains a largely unacknowledged form of discrimination. Healthcare has traditionally been viewed as a benevolent discipline in which every human life is valued equally, without any form of prejudice or discrimination. While this may remain the ideal to which healthcare aspires, the reality is that, as individuals, healthcare professionals are not immune to the influence of dominant societal understandings of, and attitudes towards, individuals and groups of people deemed to be others. Gali and colleagues observe that, despite their intentions, personal goals, and normative expectations, even health professionals are unconscious bearers of implicit social biases that affect the quality of professional interventions. They further contend that, immediately, and from early life and thereafter, people perceive individuals with disability as vulnerable and of low competence and, accordingly, treat members of this group differently. Despite the major role that medical professionals play in the lives of people with disabilities, research indicates that people with disabilities frequently encounter discrimination in healthcare settings, even in ordinary times. Studies have consistently shown that, as a group, healthcare professionals tend to substantially underestimate the quality of life of people with disabilities. Such erroneous judgments about the quality of life experienced by people with disabilities can result in treatment options for people with disabilities being either limited or altogether eliminated. At the heart of such decisions is what disability scholar Joel Reynolds has termed the ableist conflation of disability, suffering, and death. Wherever operative, the ableist conflation flattens communication about disability to communication about pain, suffering, hardship, disadvantage, morbidity, and mortality. What makes medical ableism so dangerous and so insidious at the same time is that it often presents as common sense. James Cherney argues that ableism is that most insidious form of rhetoric that has become reified and so widely accepted as common sense that it denies its own rhetoricity, it goes without saying. Within this milieu of common sense ableism, people with disabilities are routinely made vulnerable in medical settings. For example, studies have consistently shown that the emergency department environment can be stressful, and even dangerous, for people with developmental disabilities and/or communication disabilities, both because deficits associated with these conditions hamper these individuals' ability to communicate their concerns, and because staff often do not have the skills needed to work with them. The advent of COVID-19 has only exacerbated these stresses and hazards, sometimes with lethal consequences. The tragic death of Arias Knight in April powerfully demonstrates the real and present danger that medical ableism poses for people with disabilities in the wake of COVID-19. Knight was a 40-year-old BC woman who had cerebral palsy. She was nonverbal, but could communicate with her family and aides through facial expressions, which they had learned to recognize and interpret. She died of a respiratory illness on April 18th. A few days after she was transferred to the hospital from the group home in South Surrey where she had lived for a decade. Because of COVID-19 visitor restrictions, none of Knight's caregivers or family members were allowed to be with her in the hospital, and she died alone. Even prior to COVID-19, many people with disabilities, especially those with communication disabilities, have been fearful of going into emergency because their support people may not be allowed to stay with them. Arias Knight's death, and the circumstances surrounding it, sparked an outcry from disability rights advocates across the country. The newly appointed Federal COVID-19 and Disability Advisory Group, CDAG, presented an urgent recommendation to the Federal Minister of Health that she strongly encourage her provincial and territorial counterparts to revise their hospital visitation policies so as to designate family members and support workers who provide care and assistance to a patient with disabilities as essential visitors. While the Federal Minister of Health did agree to take this recommendation forward to her provincial and territorial counterparts, to date, I have only been able to confirm that visitor policies have been amended to adopt this recommendation in British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Ontario. Although this may be an incomplete list, it nevertheless speaks to the fact that recognition of the right of people with disabilities to have access to their personal support people in medical settings during this COVID-19 pandemic remains far from being universally guaranteed across Canada. For the first 2.5 months of this pandemic, we heard our Prime Minister, Premiers, and officers of public health join in unison with their counterparts around the world to repeat the mantra, flatten the curve, protect the vulnerable, stay home. The optimists among us may have been tempted to point to this as a sign of a resurgence in the value that our society attributes to the lives of vulnerable seniors and people with disabilities. The extreme optimists among us may have even been tempted to wonder if the pandemic could possibly become a catalyst for the reclamation of the notion of a common good as the core ethic of our society. Ethicist John Rawls defined the common good as certain general conditions that are equally to everyone's advantage. Ironically, in the decades leading up to this current pandemic, the notion of the common good as a viable ethical principle had, for all intents and purposes, become obsolete due to the rise of autonomy as the cardinal ethical principle in Western societies. Yet, the advent of COVID-19 seemed to bring with it a renewed recognition of the viability, indeed, the necessity, of upholding the common good as a guiding ethical principle to ensure our survival as a society. Unfortunately, however, other developments we've seen during this pandemic sharply undercut such optimism. Early on in this pandemic, in many provinces across Canada, we saw the release of critical care triage protocols which provide guidance for the allocation of critical care resources, i.e. ventilators, should they become scarce due to an overwhelming surge in critically ill patients with COVID-19. As these protocols became public, it became evident that the vast majority of them listed pre-existing disability as an exclusion criterion in the event that rationing of critical care resources becomes necessary. Again, disability rights advocates across the country, as well as the CDAG, were quick and persevering in sounding the alarm regarding the blatantly discriminatory nature of these protocols, and the extreme danger that they pose for Canadians with disabilities. Again, these concerns were relayed from a federal to a provincial level. Unfortunately, while the response on the essential visitor policy has been inconsistent, the response on discriminatory critical care triage policies has been virtually non-existent. So, where does all this leave people with disabilities still in the midst of the pandemic? Unfortunately, I think that, to a great extent, the answer to this question is found in a distinction that I alluded to at the beginning of this presentation. That is, the distinction that both the mainstream media and the general public are making between seniors in long-term care facilities, who are regularly, collectively referred to as our parents, or our grandparents, versus younger adults with physical and/or developmental disabilities, who, although they are likewise warehoused in congregate care facilities, do not share the senior's status as once having been non-disabled, contributing members of society. People with disabilities thus continue in essentially the same position that we were in before the pandemic, on the margins of an ostensibly inclusive society.
Sorry, thank you so much, Heidi. So we'll move to our last speaker, Jonathan Marchand. I hand it over to you.
Thank you, Jonas. All right. So, all right, institutions, segregation, and the way forward. Now, I was introduced by Jonas.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news I brought to you live.
That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. To stay up to date with The Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Again, that's at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788 or news at ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Hearsay. That's up next. We'll be right back.
CKUT, CKUT 90.3 FM.
KUT 90.3 FM. It's a little bit past 6 p.m. and this is In the Motherhood for March 16th, 2022. I'm your host tonight, Robin Fadden. And before we begin the show, I'd like to mention that CKUT's funding drive starts tomorrow and you can donate anytime until March 27th. And you can donate directly to this show or to any show to keep the station going strong. On today's In the Motherhood, I'm sharing a new podcast produced by Montreal nonprofit organization, the Refugee Center. And the podcast is called Point of Entry. It signifies the various points of entry made by refugees and asylum seekers around the world. Thank you very much to the Refugee Center for giving us permission to broadcast this podcast. Point of Entry explores the experiences and the challenges faced by many newcomers at various stages in their journey. This podcast transcends borders to focus on the voices behind the numbers and the policies typically associated with refugee issues. I'll be broadcasting two recent episodes of Point of Entry that focus on newcomer families. You can listen to all the episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and find those episodes at pointofentrypodcast.org. To learn more about the Refugee Center and the work they do, you can visit their website at therefugeecenter.org. You can also find them on social media. On the episodes I'll be playing today, the first is an interview with Sharon Nelson, the vice president of the Jamaican Association of Montreal. I'll play that podcast episode now.
There always has to be a voice for people who may be very shy, don't know how to express themselves, or young, or not yet at a place in their lives where they can necessarily say, I am me, and that is okay.